Hello, and welcome to the Mind Report. I'm Jonathan Phillips from Yale University's Departments of Philosophy and Psychology, and today we're talking with Eric Mandelbaum. Hey, Eric, how's it going?
I'm doing all right. I'm coming to you from Brooke College at the City University of New York, also in Departments of Philosophy and Psychology.
Okay, so Eric has done a bunch of work on belief and what it means to believe something. So that's going to be a lot of the topic today. And I think it's a nice sort of intersection between philosophy and psychology and what they can sort of say to each other in these areas. And it's nice because I think your project really begins as a strictly theoretical debate about what it means to believe something. It also has a lot of implications once you decide that for how you should, you know, change people's implicit attitudes about, say, racism or sexism. And also maybe you can explain a lot of things just more generally about why do advertisements work the way they do, or why does propaganda work the way that it does? So why don't we start with sort of the more general philosophical question about what belief is, and you can give us sort of a general sense of the way that you want to think about that, and then we can go from there to sort of more specific cases in which we can think about how that's going to play out.
Sure. So there was an old philosophical debate, many people I'm sure will be familiar with, of beliefs as functional states. Of having certain sorts of functions, whether they're going to be analytic functionalists, so that what beliefs are just these states that are given to us by everyday kind of homilies. So, you know, what it is to believe something is something that everyone knows and everybody's taught from the moment they're young, and that we are just to understand the states as a conjunction of all the kind of regular sayings about belief. And then there's a different view that saw belief as a state in real psychology, that we could have a law-like generalization covering some aspects of it, and that we could have some real science studying belief in the same way we'd study other sorts of mental states and mental representations. So call this sort of theory a psychofunctional theory.
Okay, so let's just make sure that everybody is on board, because I know this is sort of this old philosophical debate. The key difference between there are a couple key differences between these two sorts of views about what belief is. So one of them is going to be sort of what sort of thing you think a belief is. So, you know, we talk about beliefs all the time. I say this person believed that, or, you know, he knew something. There's all these ways in which we seem to talk about beliefs as though they're very real. But then on the one side, you could have a theory which doesn't sort of make strong commitments about beliefs being sort of real, rich entities. And on the other hand, you could try to treat them as like, no, that's a real psychological entity. There's some sort of, we should think about that, you know, as a real part of science.
Mm-hmm. And so it was, in a sense, a methodological project where you say, let's see if we can study these things in the same way we'd study other sorts of mental entities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very promising for the following reason. If you think it's literally true that my belief that we were supposed to meet at 2 p.m. wherever led to me showing up at 2 p.m.,
right,
then you'd think that that belief has a certain causal status,
mm-hmm,
that it was part of the etiology of my behavior.
Right.
If we want to make sense of that, a kind of plain and easy way to make sense of that is that beliefs are these real entities with causal powers, and things that have causal powers can be studied,
mm-hmm,
in the same sort of scientific way that other mental states with these powers.
Right.
So we think that your visual percept of me sitting here is causing your behaving towards it, and
mm-hmm,
we take that very, very seriously. And so the same sort of methodological presuppositions should be taken to belief. And many people did. The
right
problem is that the science of it really sort of lagged behind. And
yeah,
so philosophically speaking, people got on board with this in the late 70s and early 80s, and there was a push for these psychofunctional theories, psycho being the psychological generalizations.
Mm-hmm.
But then they just sort of died out. And they died out because the generalizations weren't forthcoming.
Right. So
you had,
it was proving to be, maybe you could think about it in comparison to, say, visual cognition or visual science. So there we've done a lot of work, and I think we've talked about some of it on the Mind Report. And we're actually, like, the science there seems to be really good in lots of ways. We can make lots of interesting generalizations. We think, you know, when the person sees this, this is sort of how they're understanding it. This is the representation they have. And we can generalize in lots of interesting ways. But maybe beliefs, like, say, the belief that, you know, that we were going to meet at 2 o'clock somewhere, that's proving to be a bit harder to study.
Yeah, and so I don't think it's an accident. I think there are interesting historical reasons why, but a lot of them were things that are philosophical dispositions against it. I think there's something not quite right about belief. And so where I've started, as opposed to having some of these just methodological debates about whether we could or could not have a full-blooded psychological theory about it, it's just trying to actually look and create one with the data that we do have. And because the science of belief has been a bit less than robust compared to, let's say, visual cognition, it's taken some work. And so the majority of my work was focused on looking at the acquisition, storage, and change conditions of belief to try to see whether there were robust generalizations. And I think that there are some and that they're sort of surprising, shocking.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, so that's I think that's a helpful way of setting up the debate. So we're really thinking about sort of the cognitive science behind belief, and then what can that tell us? But it really directly ties into these philosophical discussions in lots of ways, because philosophers have been so interested in belief for lots of reasons that I think we can get into.
And the proof is very much in the pudding. You know, if you think that there's going to be a psychofunctional theory, then you have to give some of the generalizations. You better find something that's law-like. If you can't do any of that, philosophical arguments, I don't think it's philosophical arguments that that kill many debates. You know, just as in the sciences, science progresses one funeral at a time, psychofunctional theories died because there were none offered.
Right.
So the main insight that I think starts the real scientific work on belief comes from Dan Gilbert. And what he was looking at was belief acquisition.
Okay.
So you might think that here's how, here's a kind of intuitive theory of how belief works. Let's say you're considering a certain question, the question that P, or you know, the question of who will win the World Series.
Okay.
So I give you a bunch of evidence that some certain team will win, and you, knowing not very much about baseball, just take this evidence at face value and then weigh the evidence. For a certain team winning, against another team winning, and come to a decision. And you might decide that the Yankees will win the World Series, but they won't.
Yeah.
You might suspend judgment. You might believe a little bit. And that it's this kind of rational, straightforward, very cognitive and heavy-handed act.
Right,
You just put the evidence in front of you, and then if you stop paying attention, you would just stop the process.
Right, yeah. So I'm not going to, you know, if I stop thinking about all those stats that you gave me about, you know, all the games and the playoffs or whatever, then I'm just not going to come to any sort of belief about who's going to win the World Series. I just won't have an opinion on it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What Dan was looking at was whether this sort of situation, this sort of architecture is right. And his insight was, I would put it in the following way. It's that cognition appears to have grown out of perception. And just as our perceptual faculties are by and large veridical, and we accept the deliverances of our perceptual faculties, so too did our first cognitive faculties just accept the deliverances of perception, so that the default state was to accept everything that was given to us.
Right.
So in a lot of Dan's work, what he shows is that acquiring information is not the same as rejecting information, that there's an asymmetry in our cognitive faculties. So information comes in very, very easily. Anything that's given to us, we just immediately parse. We immediately hold this attitude, this pro-attitude towards. And the pro-attitude looks to be one of belief.
Okay.
And it's only after we take this information in that we can then process and reject it. And so the idea, the, the sort of architecture that we've been building is one where anything that's processed is immediately believed.
Right.
And then that's done passively and automatically. It's a completely ballistic process. You could be half asleep. As long as the information sort of comes in, it's there.
Right.
And it's going to act as a belief.
Right. So think about maybe just to think about an example. So, you know, let's suppose I'm looking at the clouds and laying on the ground and I'm going to fall asleep. I look up and I see this face that's just in the clouds. Right. So it seems like at least for the visual part of that processing, it's just I'm automatically going to see a face in the cloud. That's just going to be exactly what I see. And then your thought is, well, suppose that someone begins giving you evidence that there is a face in the cloud, right? So if someone says there's a face in the cloud, then the belief processing works kind of the same way. It's not that I'm like, well, let me think about all my evidence and consider it to even decide whether or not I come to the belief that there's a face in the cloud. I just automatically believe there's a face in the cloud, and then I try to figure out whether or not that's right.
And that trying to figure out part is quite different in that the first part is just going to happen automatically, just like you don't try to see a scene. You open your eyes and there's the scene.
Yeah.
Whereas rejecting information is more like doing a crossword puzzle. It's going to be active. It's going to be effortful. And you can only start it when you have energy and attention. So imagine you know very little about Uganda. And I tell you that the capital of Uganda is Zimbabwe, which is, of course, false. If you're not paying attention, you'll just take this information in and then parrot it back. Now, if something catches your attention, like, wait, those both sound like country names.
Yeah.
Then you can focus on the information and actively go and reject the information.
Okay. But the rejection is sort of effortful, whereas the acquisition just may come.
Exactly. And so the idea is that it's a later cognitive and evolutionary adaptation, the ability to go and reject information. Mm-hmm. And what's later phylogenetically also appears to be later in processing and, we think, ontogenetically. So that when you process information, you first process it and it comes in, and only after can you take all of that energy to reject it. And if this is true, this has got really, really broad implications, both for our theories of how belief works and our mind structured, and also for our general buying behavior and gullibility.
Right. To back up for 1 second. So it seems like in visual processing, there is a way in which you do. It's not simply that there's some scene and we completely process the scene. There is a lot of, the way that we perceive the world is pretty rich. And you do weigh a lot of evidence for how you should interpret whatever is coming into, whatever is hitting your retina. So, if you think about cases of ambiguous figures, like, say, a duck-rabbit, where you can see it as a duck or you can see it as a rabbit, it does seem like whether or not we're seeing it as duck or rabbit, it is partially taking in certain pieces of evidence from that scene and then making a decision about whether or not to see it as a duck or see it as a rabbit, right?
Absolutely. So I guess there are two points in there I'd want to disambiguate.
Yeah.
The first is you're talking about evidence where you can choose, but of course we at the person level are very rarely choosing to do any of these things.
Right.
It's information that our cognitive system has, but that information isn't information that we at the person level are generally privy to. These decisions are being made on just too quick a scale.
Right.
And so there is some bleed in from cognition into perception, but those are in sort of specialized situations. So in situations where the information is ambiguous, and let's say you have low spatial frequency information, it'll come in, information where there are linguistic ambiguities, you'll let that sort of information come in. And this happens across language, deferred reference, you're going to have that sort of information. So yeah, I tell you they are flying planes, and and I'm looking at pilot's about to get in a plane, it gives you certain information that's coming in.
Yeah.
In general, the way that I think of this architecture, and I hope to try to keep this not incredibly technical, but let's imagine that we have a modular architecture. So that all it means is that your perceptual faculties are, by and large, these sort of autonomous systems.
Okay.
Those autonomous systems, it's the output of those that are leading to cognition. And that's where belief starts for me, that any information that's intramodular, isn't going to have the hallmark of belief. So there's two ways to think about it. Imagine that here's an example that Brian Scholl likes to use, that we have the information in our visual system that there's only one overhead light source. And you can see this information from cool studies with chickens. It looks to be innate, but it's also information that we can't really get to. The information's non-fungible.
Yeah.
Not only is it non-fungible, you can't use it as a premise in deduction.
Right.
So call any information that we can use as a premise in general thinking information that's inferentially promiscuous.
Okay.
They can get around these beliefs, the things that I'll be calling beliefs, and this is agreed upon by at least most philosophers, are things that are inferentially promiscuous, whether conscious or not. Mm-hmm. So you may not be able to use them in premises consciously, but lots of systems can access it.
Okay.
The information we have about, say, linguistic processing,
right.
It's just the linguistic processor that has that. I don't know anything about C command without going and taking graduate level courses or something like
right.
that.
So maybe the thought is, just to get us back to where mm-hmm. we started, that maybe there's, you know, at least the way that a lot of us think about the mind is that there are certain sort of smaller bits of it that sort of operate autonomously, and we call them modules. So they just sort of do their thing, and they don't get disrupted by much. They sort of, they're just some sort of process that goes given some input. Right.
So
then it's the output of those things you might think of sort of richer beliefs, and beliefs are more like the things that we're familiar with in some sense. So it's the belief that there's a face in the cloud, or belief that we're going to meet at 2.
And the other information you were talking about,
right.
it comes in and it plays a role when you can't get an output specified. So when the module can't do its work, mm-hmm. then we let other information come in. But it's very rarely information that we ourselves are making a choice on.
Right. Okay. So I think the upshot of this is that the analogy between visual processing and how you're thinking of beliefs is still going to hold in some sense.
Yeah, and it's going to be tight in very nasty ways. And in particular, if there's information that is in your environment that you'd prefer not to see, that's,
right.
you know, very damaging to your overall psychological immune system, lo and behold, if you look at it, you're going to end up seeing it. Likewise, if there's information that you'd prefer not to believe, but you encounter it,
right.
it's going to get up.
Right. So you start finding evidence that maybe your partner is seeing somebody else. You start finding notes, and you start finding someone else's underwear in the room. And then the thought is, you know, just like you can't not see, you know, the face in the cloud or the computer in front of you, you can't not believe that your partner may be cheating.
So on the acquisition, yeah.
On the acquisition, yeah.
And then, and the way these things are stored, that's where we're going to have a little bit of difference. So you might think the traditional philosophical way of thinking about belief storage, and this is also across cognitive sciences, it's given in this web of belief metaphor, where the things that are true in, let's say, the greatest amount of possible worlds, those are the things that we couldn't possibly doubt, those are in the center of the web, and they're most stable. So the idea that 2 plus 2 equals 4, the logical truths, those are the ones that are most central. I think that this is completely wrong, and the things that are most central are generally things that are very near and dear to our self-image.
Mm-hmm.
So say I go to my mom and say, Mom, these great colleagues of mine in the math department at Harvard, they have figured out that there are certain non-standard, non-linear algebras where certain things that you took to be mathematical truths don't hold, and in some of them, 2 plus 2 doesn't always equal 4.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect what she'll say is like, oh, okay. And I say, okay, Mom, we've got these amazing ethicists. My colleagues at Harvard, they're just fantastic ethicists, and we've bugged your apartment. We've been watching you for the last few months, and we have figured out that you are a terrible person. You're just a really, really bad person. And we have documented instances of you kicking puppies. This you will never, ever take on.
Right.
There's almost no amount of information that'll knock out that you're a good person,
right.
you're a reasonably smart person, you're a competent person. And so
yeah.
that sort of stuff, we will get some movement on the storage end there, but on the acquisition end, and which is where, you know, a lot of the kind of more interesting propagandistic issues come in, there we won't get any movement. The information just comes in and it's stuck.
Okay, right, good. So on the thought, not about how sort of what happens when we begin acquiring beliefs, but the thought about, you know, how do, once we first initially come to this, we see the site, we get all this evidence that, you know, I'm a terrible person. And then the one question is, do I immediately just believe it with all that evidence? And then your story is, yes, I immediately believe that I'm a terrible person, but then I reject it because I have all these sort of central other beliefs, like that I'm not a terrible person or that, you know, I'm a decent guy.
Yeah, so the idea is, so one of the philosophical debates about belief is whether belief aims at the truth, whether the real function of belief is to deliver truths. So I think the architecture that we've been creating gets the best of both worlds. It ensures that because belief comes out of, because it grew out of perception, that at least your perceptual beliefs are going to be by and large veridical. But then on the back
end... Just meaning they're true.
Meaning that they're generally accurate. But there's this other thing that we care about, and that's our psychological health. And so insofar as we have something like a psychological immune system, it pivots around these core ideas that you're a good person, that you're the type of person that wouldn't be easily fooled, that you're not a schmuck. And these kind of dissonance ideas are ideas that will set up the structuring of one's belief network.
Right.
So it's less about being accurate. You know, you might forget about a lot of those puppies you kicked.
Right.
It's more about keeping and bolstering your self-image.
Right.
And what I think the real insights of the science of belief is that the way we've set up the architectures to do these two things. Now, of course, because it's not just set up at getting truths, this is going to allow us to be easily succorable.
Right.
Perhaps an example.
Yeah, you're good.
Let's pick on cable news. And this is easy. I used to give talks where I would pick on all different news stations, but I will just pick on Fox News for this example.
Okay.
So if you watch Fox News, they're really, really brilliant, and they do this this almost beautiful thing where they just hit you with crawls, with scrolling text.
Yeah.
So you get the person, the people that are talking, and they're not just talking like us. They're more animated and much better looking. so they're more distracting. And let's start with the distraction. Distraction is really important because, remember, before we were talking about acquiring information super easy, rejecting it takes cognitive effort.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're distracted, you won't have that effort. And we can see, at least in laboratory studies, that the level of distraction needed is quite small.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask people to just not focus on something,
yeah,
don't look at the camera, that's enough distraction to knock out the rejection process.
Right.
If I tell you, don't think about the, you know, whether your fly is zipped or not, that's enough to now start this problem.
Right.
So having lots of things coming at you is another way to distract you.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of this, you have the people that are talking that are quite attractive, and then underneath them you have the crawls, the scrolling information.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know that you process that information just visually. You process linguistic information very quickly, very easily, very effortlessly. Now that's being parsed, and it's being parsed and believed on this architecture.
Right.
Even though you're not attending to it, and because you're not attending to it, it's going to really greatly affect your perceptions. And what Fox has done accidentally, the reasons why I pick on them is because I have some beautiful screenshots, is that they'll pick somebody who's been in a scandal, and they'll change their affiliation accidentally.
Right.
They'll find people who were perhaps had an R next to their name and have some type of horrible meth scandal, and then change it for a D. And of course, Fox isn't alone. You know, there's lots of horrible cable news things happening. But this is one way in which both advertisers and news channels prey on our cognitive architecture.
Right.
They present you more than one stream of information, or they present you a stream of information with a distractor cue.
Yeah.
And that distractor cuts out your ability. One thing we know is that we lose, over time, the source of where we received information from.
Yeah.
So you might forget some piece of BS information that I give you, that it came from me,
right.
The information will stick.
But I don't remember that you're the schmuck that told me that.
Yeah. You'll forget that it's Philip Morris that was telling you that tobacco is fantastic. And just remember, huh, you know, there was some groundswell of tobacco. Nicotine helps memory. I forget who tells me that nicotine helps memory.
Yeah.
So, lo and behold, it's, you know, Philip Morris.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of thing where you'll start looking around and seeing so much of your everyday marketing is set up in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Information on one end and distraction on another.
Right.
And
so if you can distract people and then give them information, and then if you're right about the sort of the science of belief, that when presented with information, we sort of initially just accept it, and then it takes a lot of effort to reject it. then that distraction will just cause us to believe whatever people are saying.
And it's, you know, it's worrisome not just in a kind of economic situations. If you think about just your regular classroom situation, mm-hmm. you know, you're a middle schooler who's going to hear information, and you're thinking, what are you thinking about? Well, you're hearing whatever the teacher's saying, but of course, you're often just worried about what your peers are thinking about you.
Right.
I mean, this information just comes in. There's a real lack of a critical analysis because of the way that our cognitive architecture is set up. If we were, I think if we really care about enhancing critical thinking, mm-hmm. one of the big things to enhance is just the skill of attending, of right. being able to shut out all this external noise.
Yeah.
And that's not something that we generally think of as a skill to be taught in education.
Right. So it depends on if you want the information that you're saying to be accepted or rejected, right? So if you want it to be accepted, I mean, maybe distractions in the classroom or on the television are the way to go. But if you want people to be critically thinking about it, then maybe one of the keys to being able to do that is to be able to shut out these sort of distractions, which may cause you to just accept the information and not fully process it and decide whether or not you want to accept it or reject it.
Yeah, look, when we're giving lectures, you know, I know Jonathan, he's pretty entertaining. His lectures are going to be pretty entertaining. And if you're giving an entertaining lecture, you have a rapt audience. But that rapt audience, them being rapt doesn't mean that they're really attending to what you're saying very closely. They're enjoying the experience, and they take away what they take away. They're not going to be able to reject that information. You might not care very much because we're not propagandizing that, you know.
Right.
It doesn't really matter if they walk away thinking all these different things about, you know, what Kant thought about what was right.
Yeah.
We want them to go back later and critically assess it.
Right.
But we have this, at least in philosophy, there's this general puzzle, let's call it a puzzle, of why so many people in graduate school end up believing or carrying the projects of their most influential undergraduate professors.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is a big reason why, that when you're encountering this information, you're encountering it, and your critical thinking is not what it is later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're encountering it, and there's all this other, I can't believe this brilliant person's talking to me. I can't believe I get to hear this lecture from Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you know, minimalist program must be right. Then 20 years later, you're still defending the minimalist program.
Right, right. And part of the interesting thing there is the reason that those beliefs might sort of stick with you so long is they become, especially if you're sort of an academic, they become part of your identity. And that is what you think is sort of central in many ways to the whether or not we change our beliefs is, well, what are the, do they challenge sort of the core part of who we think we are?
Yeah, I think it's so hard to, a new and old Brooklynite now, you look around, walking around Brooklyn, and there's all this, everybody in Brooklyn really likes to let you know that you are in Brooklyn, and that they are from Brooklyn, because it's a deep part of their identity, this general being from Brooklyn and the Brooklyn ethos of whatever hard to specify ethos it is. And that sort of thing, if you were to take it away, if that were to change, this would wreck a lot of people's view of what they are and how they're working.
Right.
On the other hand, kind of basic truths, you know, basic facts, people aren't going to care very much about unless their competence is on the line. So I have a friend that I grew up with. Here's a really upsetting anecdote. He's a perfectly smart guy. You know, he's very successful. And we were having a conversation. He doesn't care about general matters of astronomy, but we were talking about the moon. And he said, but wait, you know, the Earth, there's more than one moon. And I said, oh, yeah, well, you know, there's lots of moons, but the moon. Explain.
Yeah.
Meaning of the, and he in general couldn't care less, but now his sense of self was on the line.
Right.
You know, I was attacking his competence.
Right.
And then he just, no, there you are wrong. There are two, and this is, you know, the sort of conversation that can go nowhere. But this is when people dig their heels in, when their own sense of self's on the line. And what you start seeing is that we're not filtering information in the way that we think we should, and it's not just a matter of performance competence.
Yeah.
You have to look at how the system, our cognitive system is set up. You might think, well, we can, and it's true. At certain times, we can let information come in and weigh that information correctly. But to miss these things as just heuristics would be to miss this really important insight about how our actual cognitive system is structured.
Right. So I guess, I mean, one question then is that, so now suppose that there's a Republican and a Democrat watching Fox News, right? And so, I mean, and now they just are making mistakes where there's, you know, some Coke scandal, and it happens to be a Republican senator, but they put a D beside the name by accident. And then now the two people are watching it, and they're both distracted by it. So on your view, is it that, what's going to happen? So is the Democrat just going to accept it initially, and then, or is it, are they even going to be so distracted that they just always accept it, and they just like don't even process the fact that, you know, now they think that these liberals are cokeheads or whatever?
Yeah, so we're not going to get any difference in dispositions for accepting. Mm-hmm. We do get wide differences along two other parameters. One is individual differences in how easy it is for people to reject information.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, if you're a philosopher, you spend a lot of time thinking critically, or we'd say being skeptical and being negative. And this actually correlates very highly with a need for cognition scale. Those with higher need for cognition end up being less apt to be a yay-sayer, say yes to propositions, and more apt to be a naysayer.
Yeah.
And so those people are more apt to reject information regardless of affiliation.
Right.
But then there's this other heuristic, this actual heuristic that people use, and that's how emotionally charged you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we are just having a normal conversation and I hear somebody else across the room say, Eric, of course this is going to grab my attention.
Yeah.
Normal cocktail party.
Yeah.
In the same way, if you say a piece of information that really upsets me, it's mm-hmm. going to grab my although I'll accept that information in the same way, it's going to grab my attention way more and make the possibility of me rejecting that information or focusing on it mm-hmm. much, much higher.
Right.
So the difference in the scenario you brought is who's going to be more pissed off.
Right.
In the situation where you're just telling me, imagine that imagine that I am the staunch conservative and you put the D there, that's not going to raise my hackles.
But just think, another liberal. What do you expect?
Yeah, I'll keep going on. I won't focus on it at all. You know,
right.
It'll get almost none of right. my attention. Whatever was being said, I'll keep focusing on what was being said.
Right.
Whereas, you know, lots of times we stop processing. You can keep talking, but you say something that catches my attention, and I'm no longer really listening to you.
Right.
I'm just focused on that one piece of information.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the differences will come in. The second you say something that starts pissing people off, then they note that the rest of the information is still going to come in because they haven't shut their ears.
Right.
The only way to shut that off is to deactivate the transducer.
But
other than that, we're just going to keep the information coming in, but only focus on the one part that we want to reject.
Yeah.
So, for example, you and I are invested, we're heavily invested in the academic lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
right? We could have done other things with our lives, but we've chosen not to.
Yeah.
And so if every time we hear something about, you know, how terrible it is to be an academic, or how the institutions are dying out and
mm-hmm.
it's not important to be a professor, you know, any places that we used to be, you know, affiliated with, hearing something about that is going to catch our
right.
ear much more than it will
yeah.
Someone else's. But it's worth saying this is an equal opportunity problem. It's not a problem just for people who have certain backgrounds. The cognitive system doesn't choose based on a political disposition.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Right. Everyone can use this to their advantage or disadvantage.
Yeah. We're all equally screwed by marketers.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So, I mean, so one of the, to change topics slightly, I mean, the type of belief that you're talking about differs, you know, really, really strongly from the type of beliefs that philosophers, in particular epistemologists who are interested in what it means to say no something, have thought a lot about.
Yeah. I would say that there are a few important differences,
mm-hmm.
and the main one is, look, if you receive information that P and you receive information that not P,
mm-hmm.
So you receive information that you're a good person. You receive information that you're a terrible person. We would generally think this is inconsistent information, right, and that on the traditional view, we can't have contradictory beliefs. And so that you weigh these for and against each other, and that you decide on one. But if the architecture is as I've specified, you know, in this sort of Gilbert architecture, you accept whatever information is given to you. And so if you're given P and you're given not P, you're going to form two beliefs, one that's the belief that P and one that's the belief that not P.
Right.
And so a lot of the norms that held a belief, the sorts of generalizations that philosophers thought that you couldn't believe contradictory, you couldn't have contradictory beliefs, mm-hmm, seem to have to fall by the wayside.
Right.
And so I don't feel so – this doesn't keep me up at night, because people just do appear to hold contradictions all over. So, you know, you ask people right before that have low self-esteem what they think of themselves, and they'll say that they're pretty terrible people.
Yeah.
And then they'll go and they'll volunteer at a soup kitchen, yes, and then they'll think they're pretty good people.
Right.
And that they'll hold both beliefs. Those beliefs have their own inferential circles. They don't interact.
Right.
So what we have to do is sever this idea of there being one web of belief.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, these are not these are very normal things. You know, an old co-author and friend, Dave Ripley, has studies where he asks people about vague cases whether they would like to assert contradictions or not, and they prefer to assert contradictions, say that thing's kind of that person's kind of bald and not bald. People don't have problems with this.
Right. Yeah, so I guess there are two questions. One is just the science of belief question, right, which is just like, what are beliefs and how are they working? And then maybe it seems like the more you look at empirical evidence for it, you just find so many contradictions all over the place that maybe, you know, good thinking that we can't hold contradictory beliefs isn't going to be a good way to think about it from the science perspective. Then you might also think, well, there's this other more normative question, this question about, you know, should we hold contradictory beliefs? And then maybe the epistemologists there are still going to be fine in saying, well, you shouldn't do that. I mean, of course, maybe you do all the time, but that's a different question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difficult question in epistemology as it arises in ethics too, which is a question of the relation between ought and can. But let's just it seems fine for me to agree with basic norms saying, look, you shouldn't believe everything that you think. just because you thought it, you shouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Maybe we can't do that, but it's probably best not to have contradictory beliefs. It's probably best, you know, for us to have a coherent network and have all of our credences work out in the right way. Of course, in everyday life, we're real people trying to get through, and mm-hmm, we want some kind of easier rules of thumb. So, you know, look, a lot of this Descartes had right originally. You know, if you want to know what you really should believe, shut out the outside world, go to the fire, and just freaking focus for a little. That seems like reasonable advice. But you know, you often can't do that. So epistemologists, they don't like a lot of what I say and a lot of what the science of belief looks like. Of course, not liking it's not an argument against it. They might argue that these states don't look to be beliefy in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the other way in which they differ, and this is, I think, important in a more general political sense, is the, oddly enough, is the sort of structure you might think these states have.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people, a very old theory is that these states just are associative,
mm-hmm,
and this is still believed in a lot of social psychological circles. And an associative state is kind of a reflexive, really, really dumb state.
Yeah.
So imagine that Skinner was right. B.F. Skinner is often parodied, maybe not parodied, sort of rightly so, held a lot of these ideas that what we believe and how we act is just based on how we've been reinforced.
Mm-hmm.
So you give me positive reinforcement for something, and then I'll do that thing more.
Yeah.
You give me negative reinforcement for something, then I'll do that thing less. Okay. So you reinforce the pigeon when they're turning, and then we can get them to start churning all the time, and then you get, you know, these pigeons that just kind of spin around because they've been on an intermittent reinforcement pattern.
Right.
And so Skinner thought what was true for the pigeons is true for us.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have thought this about beliefs too. that what we believe are just the things that we've been reinforced for. And to be fair, there's some reason for this. Think about how many people just believe the things that their parents believe.
Or all of the, you know, it, say, I mean, racism is an interesting case. If you see a lot of stereotypically bad characters of some particular race, you might just think what you're doing is you're forming an association with, you know, bad or dumb or good at math or whatever with some particular race.
Yeah, so here's where I think a really deep and important consequence of a lot of this work comes out. There's one on political end and one on the Coxsackie end. So there's been this idea that implicit attitudes are what underwrite implicit racism, and that these things are somehow associations. And you can go and take an implicit attitude test, and you can take it for just about anything. And here's the general principle. If there's a stereotype that you think our culture has, then lo and behold, most people will show it implicitly, that they will be, say, quicker to associate African-American faces with negative words than they will with positively valenced words.
And that's true even if you are African-American in lots of cases.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's true even if you have explicitly egalitarian attitudes. That's what's really upsetting. If you sit there and say, no, 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 I think that there's no difference between the races, I think that we're all equal and that everything's wonderful, you'll still be apt to show it regardless. And now the percentages differ, but it holds for, you know, women in science and men in emotion and ageism, and you know, there's an age bias, that one kind of sad because people explicitly are generally age biased too. They think that it's worse to be older. Most of these, thankfully, we have explicit bias isn't there.
Yeah.
So most people won't say for a lot of these explicit biases that they're good. So the idea is that these underlying states, these implicit states, are associations, and that they're dumb.
Right.
That they're the sorts of things that we just catch from, you know, watching Law and Order and seeing that the perpetrator is African American. And that we can move them around, that you modulate them by a series of reinforcements, some positive, some negative.
Right. So if you want to reverse that, just make Law and Order. I mean, on what the associative view you're talking about, if you want to reverse that racism, just make Law and Order episodes in which the African American is the good cop who's saving people, not the criminal.
Absolutely. And that you know, we can bring you in the lab and we just show you a bunch of really well-respected, super positively valenced African-Americans and a bunch of terrible Caucasians, and this will go away. So you just get, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer and Michael Jordan and Denzel Washington and I forget who else. This is actually a study. I'm just trying to remember who they chose to use.
Yeah.
You know, you put Nelson Mandela up and you put Joseph Stalin up and you watch them in a kind of Clockwork Orangey way long enough, and lo and behold, your attitudes will flip. And lo and behold, this doesn't seem to be right. This is just not working. And it's been, you know, there's been very few successes. And the idea, the Coxsackie idea behind it, is that your explicit attitudes are this kind of high road process where we can bring all this information in, and that's where your beliefs are. These implicit attitudes are just associations, and they're kind of stupid. And I think that this is pretty wrong in both aspects. So it looks like that the things that we hold, that we were talking about before, beliefs, are generally unconscious, and that they are what people think of as the kind of lower phylogenetically ancient system, but that they're not merely associative, that we take them on automatically, and so they have some what we might think of as dumber aspects, but that really they are reason responsive, and they're responsive to reasons in ways that we haven't thought of before. So one thing that I've been working on recently is going through a lot of interventions into racism and interventions into implicit attitudes and looking at what's worked and what hasn't. And by and large, what hasn't worked is this associative reinforcement. But what oddly enough does is when you give people reasons for not holding these attitudes that they don't think they hold.
Right.
This is why it's sort of weird.
Right.
I ask you, do you think that Caucasians are superior to African Americans? And you say, of course not, being a reasonable person.
Yeah.
And then I say, okay, well, even though you said that, now I'm going to give you a bunch of reasons to think that, in fact, both races are equal and that there's no reason to be superior. You might think this is kind of dumb.
Right. I mean, they already have the explicit belief that they're not any better. So then why would all this evidence change anything? Right.
So what's odd is that our explicit beliefs and what we tell people we judge, I don't want to call those beliefs at all because they don't seem to affect our behavior. They seem to be kind of face-saving BS that we tell each other. You know, I am gonna quit smoking and become president of the United States. Yeah. All right, great, high five. You go and do that. But you see that those sorts of statements have very little purchase over the predictive value of behavior. But it's these implicit states that we were looking at earlier, these other types of belief states that do seem to predict behavior, not always that high level, but at least they get some purchase. And so if you say, even though I believe that say, it's no better to be fat than skinny, I'm still going to give you some arguments why, you know, it's no better morally. These people are no different. Let me just give you some arguments. And what you see is when you actually give these arguments to people, when you give evidence, that changes people's opinions. And this shouldn't be all that surprising. And when I say opinions, what I mean is it changes their low-level reactions on these implicit tests.
Right. So it really changes it seems like what you're saying is the best way to change people's implicit associations, say with, you know, that fat people or overweight people don't work hard enough, or that you know, Asian people are cold or something like that, is actually to give them a lot of evidence that they're not that way. And that's what's going to change it. Not just showing them lots of, you know, Asian people being warm and with their families or something like that. What you need to do is give them reasons, and that's going to, even though that's not going to change their explicit attitude because they already had that explicit attitude, it's going to change the low-level things.
It's very ironic. So there's here are a few of the ironies. So you'd think that because the system is one that takes on beliefs automatically, the system is dumb, and that because you explicitly hold this belief, there's no use in giving this information. However, again, part of the competence of the system is being reason responsive. Mm-hmm. And the reasons that the system's responsive to aren't always the ones that we would particularly care about. So, for example, there's one study, we can link to all these below, but where you just tell college students what their peers think. Mm-hmm. So you take people who think that, let's say, African Americans are inferior to Caucasians, then you just say 85% of your peers disagree, and they think that, in fact, both races are equal. And then, lo and behold, that one piece of information, you know, it's a one-time manipulation, and that changes the attitudes. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be giving, you know, treatises on these.
Right.
And is that the greatest piece of information? I don't know. Testimony for peers. It's okay. It's not as great as other ones. It's not terrible. But it's not the sort of thing that you'd think would move deep-seated attitudes. You look at these conditioning studies, they'll give you 250 trials, they move nothing, whereas just telling you a little bit about your peers will change attitudes. And so it's very different. It's a very different conceptualization from the kind of overarching way that we might have thought of dual systems approach to the mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one question, though, then is, like, you're saying that these implicit systems are really smart, and they can do a lot of inferential processing, and they can come to good considerations. But then it seems like initially, I mean, the problem that we have with implicit racism or implicit biases is that, well, how did we get that attitude anyway? If these systems are so smart, then how did we end up with that belief? So we just need to give it the right sort of evidence to change it. I mean, was the problem that we were getting the wrong evidence all along?
It's a really difficult and wonderful question. So I don't have much of an answer. I'll give you a few other people's answers, and then I'll tell you vaguely what I think. So, for example, you know, Tamar Gindler has an interesting paper that I find worrisome, where she thinks, well, look, what people are doing is they're encoding base rates from what they encounter. Mm-hmm. They're just doing this implicitly. It's a statistical updater, and it's what you get, and that it's a deep normative problem for us that our attitudes are going against this kind of just updating.
Yeah.
I tend to think that belief acquisition is far less rational. We haven't talked about belief change, but in general, I should just say I'm very skeptical of Bayesian accounts of belief acquisition and Bayesian counts of belief change, they're a little bit too rational. I tend to think that beliefs are caught like colds. You just kind of encounter the information. You don't know where you get it from. Right. You just hear it and it sticks.
Yeah.
And things that will stick longer are ones that kind of cohere with lots of other information. If you look at pockets of where you get less implicit racism, you're not going to be so surprised to hear that it's in places where you're raised in multicultural, multi-ethnic neighborhoods. And so, you know, if you're... If you grow up in a perfectly good, super liberal, totally nice neighborhood that nonetheless is just filled with people going to Belle and Sebastian shows and is super white, you know, you're going to – the chances of you catching these negative implicit attitudes are just higher, even though it's a good, liberal, egalitarian environment.
Right.
How that happens, you know, it's overdetermined in a society like ours, right, where you just – if you ask people – what are the stereotypes? To just list the stereotypes we have against any property. Just take 5 minutes and list everything that comes to mind. People won't have any trouble doing that.
Yeah.
Where that comes from is a bit perplexing. I'm less sanguine about the idea being that we're actually encoding base rates as opposed to parroting information. I think a big problem is that when people say that they're egalitarian or when people say that they don't think that you know, women are better at emotion than men, or that men are better at math than women, and they think that those things are false, they've actually never thought about it. That they're parroting it in the same way that they parrot that the, you know, what the capital of Nebraska is. It's just information that we've learned in semantic, we've encoded in semantic memory, and we're giving out.
We've heard it in some way, and we've sort of taken it on board. We haven't really considered it because it seemed fine. But then maybe part of the change would be that it was just the more that we actually do think, okay, wait, is that really right? And then we come to agree, we'll do that process by considering other evidence. Yeah, and so in some sense you could actually change racism, not even by having to give people different, you know, more stimuli or more examples of someone being good or more information about what your friends think, but just by getting them to think for a little while about whether or not that's really something they want to do.
Always bizarre for a philosopher who really is in cognitive science to have the cognitive science lead them back to philosophical moral. And I think that's what you see here is that, you know, the cognitive science tells you is that the best way to deal with this stuff is the way that, you know, you might have thought philosophical reflections should work.
It's where we started.
A lot of these racial sensitization trainings aren't focused on that. You know, they're not focused on having you think about the reasons you have for these attitudes and what evidence you have for it. And, you know, even I think a lot of people that we think are really well-meaning, egalitarian, good moral people have similar problems because they take these attitudes on because it's part of the kind of general ethos.
Right.
But they don't think about why they have them. And let's be clear. You can be perfectly good egalitarian explicitly. If you have these implicit attitudes, these negative implicit attitudes, bad behaviors will come. Even if you don't know you harbor them, you'll do things. A lot of social signaling. You'll smile less. You'll make less eye contact. You'll rate them
further
less.
Away. You'll be less likely to consider them for job applications.
Yeah, have higher fear response. Cross the street more. And feel less comfortable in mixed neighborhoods. You know, these are the sorts of things that it's shocking to think that philosophical reflection would help. But good Lord, it looks like that's the moral. And the idea is that we've got to somehow get hold of these unconscious beliefs and that you do it actually via reflection.
Yeah, that's an interesting... It always is interesting when cognitive science leads you back to where philosophy started.
I know.
I mean, so one tension it feels like in the general theory that you're putting forward comes to a point if you think about, say, an African American person who has an implicit association with African American and bad. So on the one hand, you know, on the one hand, it seems like they're going to have a lot of evidence. Maybe they're going to have a lot of evidence that they just pick up through the environment, and maybe that's partially why they form this implicit association. Maybe you can be right about that. But then on the other hand, it seems like they're going to be really invested. I mean, as the way that you talk about it, the belief that I'm an African-American and that I'm not bad are going to be really at the core of what you're calling the web of belief, or you might just think of it as like sort of their system of understanding themselves or their identity.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's very problematic in that it's something that happens. I see it as a kind of insight into the way these things are structured. So let's pan out a little bit and say you can imagine that you have a single web of belief where really what you're doing is changing the weights of different beliefs so that things turn out okay, that by and large you have consistent beliefs as much as possible. I think that instead what we have is we have a whole bunch of different stores in memory that we call beliefs that are by and large not interacting, that they're sequestered from each other, that you can bring them to interact, but you can only do it via top-down integration, that you focus on it, you have two beliefs that are salient, and you make those merge. Mm-hmm. And that what's happening for people who both self-identify very strongly with this group is good and have these biases against this group. And by the way, you in fact see this everywhere. When you look at people who work very closely with groups that are minorities or that are disadvantaged, mm-hmm. those people often have the highest amount of implicit bias towards those groups. And that what they're doing is they're flipping back and forth, that you can't help but encounter this information, but you try your best to sequester it. Mm-hmm. But you trying your best to sequester isn't getting that information to go away. Mm-hmm. So there's this other idea that often comes up that people pretend is legitimate, which is that we have some sort of a race function on belief. That I believe, let's say I've been a theist my whole life,
right.
and that, you know, at age, 65, I now think, oh my God, I was wrong. There is no God. There's what was I doing with my life?
Yeah.
That suddenly I no longer have the belief that God exists and that this it hasn't left any traces.
Yeah.
Instead, what I think we do for any of these beliefs, when we want to reject something, is we try it the best we can to prune its inferential connections, to take mm-hmm. away what it's associated with and what we've inferred from it. And to sequester it the best we can. Likewise, when we have information that we don't reflexively endorse, that isn't consistent with our self-image, we can't just make that information go away. What we do is we push it out as much as possible.
Right.
The real brilliance of a lot of these tests, so take the implicit association test, you know, what Greenwald and Banaji did, and what's really brilliant about their setup, is that they found a way to tap into attitudes, say beliefs that we hold, that are ones that we want to tamp down and aren't being aren't well inferentially integrated.
Mm-hmm.
They're ones that pop up a lot. They have strength. We can tap into them because they're highly associated with a concept, and so our concept will have these two opposite associations.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, your concept of African-American will have this, no, it's I very strongly believe that they're equal, and this negative valence that, you know, let's say African-Americans are dangerous, and that we've sequestered them, and that what they can do is they can cut through a lot of what we want to do top-down because, for example, the test moves too fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to respond too quickly. And so, I mean, look, this is what clever psychologists do. Right?
Yeah.
They find a way around it. So back to your original question, there's a tension there. I find the tension to be insightful into the way that these things are set up. If you start caring about belief storage,
right,
this gives you an insight into how beliefs are stored. It takes a kind of perverse person to care about belief storage. But to come back to what we started with, if you want a real science of belief, if you want a real theory of it.
Right.
You need
to account for these sorts of data. I mean, the other thing that I think that you could say in a case like this is, well, think about not just the belief that, you know, I'm black and that I'm a good person and I'm not dangerous. Think about the other types of beliefs that they might have that are also sort of at the center of their web. So really interesting, I think it goes really well with this idea that people that actually try to help, you know, disenfranchised minorities or in these cases often have really strong implicit associations with them and negative attitudes. Mm-hmm. So, but if you think, well, one of the things that's at the core of that person's sort of web of belief is that I'm a person that helps helps people that are well, less well off, or helps people that have some sort of negative or that need help in some important way, then maybe, I mean, part of that is going to imply that that person is less well off, or that is not doing as well in some way. So you might think that the inferences that they have to make sort of unconsciously are actually it's going to be important for their understanding of themselves to have that belief, that negative belief is playing some sort of role even in their web.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's, sadly, most of us get into what we think of altruistic and selfless work because we think it's needed in a certain way.
Yeah.
And it's needed because as much as we'd like to convince ourselves otherwise, sometimes, you know, the socially unacceptable thing is true. So I would say what's more upsetting to me is I have a friend who consistently sends me these stories, and what he sends me is people who are working with disenfranchised groups that then turn on those mm-hmm. disenfranchised groups and do something terrible. You know, you'll see people who murder Native Americans who were working with Native Americans for years and years and years.
Yeah.
People who work with who spend their life working for battered women's associations that then end up engaging in domestic violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of this, I think where we were, where cognitive science got off the boat and where Skinner was wrong was thinking that these states move via reinforcement. But where they were right, where there was actually was some insight, is thinking that merely bringing a state over and over again, mm-hmm. increasing its salience and activating that state, activating a belief over and over again, raises its salience and raises, I don't want to say its credence because you get us to a whole other can of worms, but raises the possibility of you acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very worrisome to constantly have thoughts that we think are psychologically both psychologically damaging and normatively non-respectable. So if I have to constantly all day think about really terrible things,
mm-hmm.
Thinking that I can then just sequester it and not have it bleed into everyday life is a bit foolish. You know, there's a debate about doxastic voluntarism, how to get yourself to believe something.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. You know, if I want to believe that you're a giant snake right now, it's
pretty hard.
But tell yourself over and over again, Al Gore is a good presidential candidate. Al Gore is really going to do great. He's not stiff at all. And you can start getting that in there. Now, even if you're trying to counteract these thoughts, the more they come up, and look, I mean, people I think are wising up to this in all sorts of ways, thinking that you can spend all day thinking about pornography and just writing about it as a philosopher and what's wrong with it and not have those tropes play in,
mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. Right. I think it's, you know, the veil of objectivity for those of us who think about horrible things, sadly the mind doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You know, we have to habituate.
Yeah, and I think it is a really interesting example of people who explicitly are just working against these things, but because of the salience of that thing in their life, maybe they come up, they in some sense are just very subject to the very thing they're working against.
And you know, it's not self-serving, so there's a very famous case right now that's coming out in philosophy of a famous philosopher who's was accused of different things, maybe sexual harassment, maybe not sexual harassment, and he's put a lot of uncomfortable blog posts on. And part of what's so uncomfortable about his blog post recently is that they all just claim that he is just this wonderful, non-sexist, the biggest champion of women out there. And people, I think, might think this is disingenuous. I'm sure he legitimately thinks this.
Yeah.
And that, you know, part of it, he's thought a lot about what's appropriate and inappropriate to do with female graduate students, and that might have had its own effect on his behavior.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it's just self-serving when people say, no, I care a lot about this thing that I just acted completely against.
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, that's, yeah. I think that it's a...
so sad. So, yeah, if you want to make sure you never... so never work on sexual harassment boards.
Yeah.
That's not the moral.
That is what philosophy and cognitive science have brought us to. And maybe that's a good lesson to end on.
So sad.
No. But yeah, I do think, the view is definitely interesting, and it's a nice sort of relationship between philosophy and cognitive science. And it seems to have real world implications.
Look,
if this is right. So,
you know, what are we doing this for? Part of what we're doing this for is to figure out cognitive architecture. I want to know how the mind's set up. Our main theory is we know that there's some problems with dual process theories, that there's some holes in it, and we need something else. It would be nice if it illuminated something about everyday life. I'm sure this is going to be wrong. Everything we do in cognitive science is bound to be wrong. It's cognitive science.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be wrong in the right sort of ways.
Yeah. It's a good wish.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thanks for talking.